I have to thank the Philadelphia Society for giving me this coveted spot as the last speaker on early Sunday morning.
You chose it.
I did actually choose it. I'll try to keep it brief because I would like to leave time for discussion, which is, after all, the most interesting part. I want to start off by talking about what I think are some fairly serious problems for restoring a constitutional judiciary. I want to mention three in particular. One is the simple fact that there is a very widespread commitment of legal elites and intellectuals to the notion of a living or evolving constitution philosophy that serves as a rationalization for judicial activism. And by judicial activism, I mean something like what I thought John Eastman expounded very well with respect to Marbury versus Madison. And that's the idea that we've had a fundamental shift in the notion of judicial review. That phrase is used equivocally. It means different things when people use the term. For Marshall and early Americans, what it meant is that judges could strike down a law that was clearly contrary to the Constitution. Virtually the definition of modern judicial review is that you start out with certain phrases in the Constitution which are allegedly majestic generalities that are rather vague, and somebody needs to flesh them out and give them content. You know, due process clause, equal protection clause, and so forth. And so the result is that the judges are actually, in effect, giving content to the Constitution through judicial review rather than enforcing the Constitution. And that's just a fundamental shift in the notion of judicial review, which gives a lot of discretion to judges to seek policies that they consider best for the nation. And the problem that we face is that a very large majority of legal elites, intellectuals, accept that more modern activist understanding of judicial power. Holmes won on that, you know? Second problem, constitutionalists find themselves in a very difficult position with respect to judicial activism because it's, you know, politically speaking, it's a kind of, you know, heads they win, tails we lose. And the image I have in mind is something like this. You have two people, and they have this thing that they have to pass back and forth, holding it with two hands. And they have to hold it for 30 seconds, and then they give it to the other person. And then during that time that the other person doesn't have something in his hands, he can do what he wants to. So we have, you know, conservative, you know, people with respect to, you know, more originalist notions. You have more liberal or evolving constitutional people, and they're handing this back and forth. So the conservative, hands this thing to the liberal, and then, you know, kind of talks with the liberal and says, let's reason and let's kind of interpret the Constitution. Then the liberal hands it back to the conservative who holds it, and the liberal punches him. You know, then after 30 seconds, the conservative gives it back to the liberal and he says, really, you know, we have to, let's reason about this thing. Let's look at the text. And then the liberal hands it back and punches him again. You know, that is, liberals, when they're in charge, get to use judicial activism to pursue the goals they want to pursue. And then when conservatives get in power, they are advocates of judicial self-restraint who try to stick to the Constitution. So what is the incentive for liberals not to advocate judicial activism? Now, of course, if conservatives were using a kind of conservative judicial activism, you know, then that might cause liberals to think twice, right? On the abortion issue, for example, we've never actually had anything like a conservative judicial opinion on abortion. We've had all anti-judicial activism opinions on abortion. A more activist conservative position, although just for the record, it's a much more plausible interpretation of the Constitution than Roe versus Wade, would be the idea that no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. You know, prenatal life may be prenatal, but it's still human life, and so those are still persons. And therefore, laws permitting abortion are actually a quintessential example of a state refusing to give a category of persons the equal protection of the law. Literally, right? That's basically, it's authorizing, in a way, you know, private lethal power directed against this particular category. Now, I wouldn't actually adopt that position myself, but as I say, it's a heck of a lot more plausible than Roe versus Wade. You know, it fits the language of the document much better. What might liberals think about judicial activism if the alternative to their position wasn't judges simply saying, well, we're going to stay out of it, but judges actually getting into it and pursuing conservative goals? You know, now, I'm not advocating this because I actually believe in integrity. You know, that actually we have principles and we ought to actually stick with those principles and not just do things because they're politically desirable or useful. But that's a problem for us, that judicial activism is really a kind of no-lose situation for the most part for more liberal legal thinkers. A third problem for restoring a constitutional judiciary is that the people who study law forget how complex law is. You know, I don't know, those of you who are lawyers or interested in constitutional law, you know, if you've ever gone to a dinner party and, you know, somebody kind of raised an issue or a case or whatever, and you start kind of talking about, you know, the proper interpretation of the Constitution and, you know, what the proper framework for understanding the case is. You know, and if you had the experience of the eyes kind of glazing over, you know, because what seems kind of simple to a lot of us who are, you know, think about this stuff and talk about it all the time, to other people just seems really, really abstruse. You know, the result is that kind of ordinary citizens, to a great extent, really make judgments, both on the conservative and liberal side, because of a kind of result orientation, rather than out of a deep constitutional principle. Take one example in my lifetime, not a lot of years, but you know, the late 1960s, you know, Richard Nixon ran against the Supreme Court, basically, you know, ran against Matt and Miranda. You know, that because, you know, crime was an issue in the late 60s, and a lot of people were upset about that because the court had in some ways really undermined ways in which they could, police it, could restrict crime more. And, I mean, there are debates about the issue, but it didn't really come down to any refined constitutional analysis. You know, Nixon actually won that election, partly because he ran successfully on that issue, but it wasn't because of some kind of refined interpretation of the Bill of Rights. It was because a lot of people just thought that it was crazy letting guilty people go free. You know, we shouldn't be doing that. You know, we should have law and order. And so, I mean, to some extent, even the people who kind of back us sometimes very often do so for the wrong reasons. And that's one reason why the, you know, judicial nominations are so bloody these days. So those are some of the problems, and they're pretty significant problems that we face. Can the Constitution be saved? Let me say a few words about that. The first thing we need to do is to recognize that there have been really profound changes in the American Constitution small c. That is, in some ways, the real Constitution. And I think that a lot of people here won't be happy to hear this, but I think, in fact, that a good deal of this change is irreversible. You know, we are not going back to a 19th century national government whose most significant contact with Americans day-to-day was the post office, or in which people are fundamentally more attached to their states than to the nation. That's just not going to happen. I mean, there have been very profound changes, and a lot of that is pretty irreversible, I think. One example, again, you know, Justice Thomas may disagree with me on this, but I don't think incorporation, application of the Bill of Rights to the states, is in any way likely to be overturned. I think there are actually pretty good arguments for doing it. And as a matter of original intent, it obviously is the case the Bill of Rights didn't apply to the states, and I don't think the 14th Amendment intended to apply it. But, you know, that is so deeply embedded in American law that it's not likely to be reversed. That leads to the whole question of precedent, which is a difficult question. It involves originalist judges in making precisely the kinds of things they'd rather not do, which is making prudential judgments about which precedents ought to be maintained and which ones not. And of course, there are significant differences among conservatives on this, you know, Scalia and Thomas. Although it's, keep in mind that even Scalia, while who accepted precedent more than Thomas, had one very interesting rule on precedent, which helps to explain the Smith case in Free Exercise, and that is he would not accept a precedent that compelled him to act as something other than a judge. And because he thought that the Free Exercise jurisprudence made him act as a legislator, he was willing to, you know, overrule, well, in effect, overrule the previous, you know, 27 years of jurisprudence in the Smith case in 1990. So, you know, actually deciding which precedents are the ones that are reversible and which ones to go after is one of the key questions conservatives have to face. I'll end, though, by commenting that there is some possibility of retrenchment. You know, originalism was virtually dead when I was in graduate school. It was back in the early 1970s. It was difficult to get most legal scholars even to take the issue seriously. And that is profoundly different today. And I must say that the Federalist Society in particular played an enormous role in that change, both by providing scholarship and by providing personnel for the courts. Another good piece of news is Republicans have figured out that they haven't done a really good job with just judicial appointments. You know, but there's actually been a problem sometimes with judicial appointments by Republican presidents over the years. And a lot of them are really determined that it not happen again. And Leonard Leo and others did, I think, a great job working with President Trump on the Gorsuch appointment. And so that's good news. On the other hand, you know, the Gorsuch, you know, appointment, is all it does is restore the status quo ante. It doesn't give us, you know, so we still have Kennedy's swing vote, which means we're in pretty bad position. And we don't know for sure with Trump. He promised that the first appointment would be from the list of 21, and that's a great list, by the way. But the problem is he didn't promise that subsequent appointments would be from that list of 21. And no, Trump being Trump, it's not clear that we can count on him to make as good appointments in the future as he did this time. But still, the good news is we have a chance. Imagine a President Clinton. You know, that would have been an unimaginable constitutional catastrophe. And so we should be thankful for little things.